Jimmy Smith on his trusty Hammond B3 organ. His female counterpart, I must say, is Shirley Scott. Nobody is allowed to say anything bad about Shirley Scott in my presence. It just is not allowed. The woman is an absolute fiend on the Hammond B3. This tune by Jimmy Smith goes on for more than 20 minutes. Of course, we can't play the whole thing, but I just wanted to acquaint you, or perhaps even reacquaint you, with his mastery of this instrument. Lee Morgan joins him on trumpet, Lou Donaldson on alto sax, Tina Brooks on tenor sax, Kenny Burrell on guitar, and Art Blakey on drums. This was the title track of the album Smith released in 1958. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And my gosh, I can't keep up with the pace of things. You just can't keep up. It literally changes minute to minute. But first, let's talk about Jimmy Carter, who reportedly has come through his surgical procedure to release pressure on his brain. More than likely, doctors said, the result of falls he recently had, hit his head really hard. And good thing, he came out of surgery today in fine shape. Hopefully that keeps up and sees him through quite a long time more. He's up in years now, 95, but he has proven himself to be a different kind of president, very humane, very much involved in responding to people's needs, and he wasn't doing it for show. This was something that was an organic part of him. And although people made fun of him as a country bumpkin from Georgia, the fact is that he had good old-fashioned values about, they would call it Christian values, but really it's about being raised right to care about your neighbor and helping others. So I said a little something for him this morning, and I'm hoping that he heals and continues on his path. Well, add one more name to the list of possibles for the presidential race. I think I'll run. Everybody seems to be running. Everybody seems to be a likely candidate. And now we have one more, the former governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick. supposedly people close to him who are in the business of politics are encouraging him to consider running for president. And, well, he hasn't made an announcement one way or the other. But when you start hearing stories about somebody being coaxed or encouraged to run for office, it means that he's been considering this. And the more big name people who pile on and join the conga line, hoping that he would take their hint and in fact declare, the more likely it is that this has been going on for some time. But anytime you hear things like this, this kind of news, a person, while you know a campaign is in full swing or really picking up speed, and out of nowhere a name pops up. We have had one such name before, Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of the city of New York. Now we have Deval Patrick, who is being wooed and being encouraged to consider running for president. Now, when you hear this kind of news, you always have to think twice. Excuse me. What does this mean? That's the question you always have to ask. What does it mean when all of a sudden you have Bloomberg on one hand, you have Deval Patrick on the other? It means that there is a recognition that the herd, the current herd of candidates, has something lacking in the eyes of experienced political types. It's all well and good to say, well, you have 15, 20, 30 people running, but that's not necessarily a good thing. You want quality, not quantity. So somebody or some persons who are adept political observers and practitioners apparently have surveyed the field and believe that there is room for somebody of tested capability. And so they, you know, Bloomberg, they went after him. Well, I don't know if anybody had to go after him. I think he went after himself. But really, you look at it as an expression of concern within the party. Nobody's going to say it out loud. But you can surmise with reasonable confidence that there is concern about the quality of the candidates who are running and who, for whatever reason, are not striking the right chord with people who are astute observers of politics. For some reason, they may think that the current crop of candidates running under the Democratic banner would probably not excite the broadest band possible of Democrats. And in this way, they have to do something to rev things up, to increase broader interest, or to turn on people who already are turned off. Now, is Deval Patrick the answer? He could be. For people who are happy to see that a person of color has come to the attention of the powers that be within the Democratic Party, he is tested. He was governor of Massachusetts. He's not one of those way out there type of Democrat. He is conservative, and he is a much safer bet He's not likely to, you know, make news. He's likely to attract that element within the Democratic Party that thinks the party is too far left. He may be the guy who some people within the Democratic Party say, this is the kind of candidate we need who could bring all the different factions under the Democratic umbrella together. So why don't we court him? Why don't we encourage him to run? And supposedly he's thinking about that. Now, of course, this has downsides, but I'm just trying to share with you, when these things happen, they're not by accident. And we always have to ask, what could be the reason? And I'm proposing, I'm surmising, that the reason is that somewhere within the Democratic Party, there is concern that there isn't a candidate running who isn't left, way out left, or even somewhat left, but dead in the middle, and who has all the credentials, who fits all the criteria for leadership at this time. Steady, conservative guy, tested, and possibly the answer to what the Democratic Party needs at this time. We don't know. I'm just suggesting. So that was a very interesting surprise that he pops up and the way they put it always, they always put it this way, about people trying to persuade him to run, which is a way of putting out to the public, you know, a test question. Do you think he ought to run? I mean, that's the way they do it. The people are asking him to run and trying to encourage him to run. That's the way they would frame it, so that it doesn't look like he's so ambitious. He wants to climb over everybody who's there, but that, in fact, he's responding to a popular mandate to run, which makes it safe for him to enter the fray, if he so chooses, without stepping on anybody's toes. We'll see how it works out. But that is a very interesting way to put it. Well, we heard from Condoleezza Rice yesterday. Condoleezza Rice, you may recall, was the Secretary of State under George Bush. And she was concerned, she was particularly concerned about what she called a deeply troubling evidence of irregular channels in foreign policy. What does she mean by that? Now, you see, this is a difference between a Trump kind of administration and a Condoleezza Rice type of experience. It doesn't sound vicious at all, but it is one hell of a condemnation. And listen to the words that she says. She finds it, quote, deeply troubling. That doesn't sound bad, does it? But in diplomatic language, that is a big, big deal to say that. Here is a former Secretary of State under one of the most conservative Republican presidents, right? She's admired for her accomplishments in foreign policy. And she says she finds it, quote, deeply troubling. What does she find deeply troubling? Irregular channels of the people involved, and she specifically aimed at the Ukrainian situation. Now, that is a very diplomatic way of cussing people out. What she's saying is that they're not doing things the right way. They are creating their own ways of doing things, which very possibly, and that's the insinuation, which very possibly go against the grain not only of established U.S. policy, but established international policy. And very possibly, she was hinting at the what she suspects was a criminal element involved. What else could she mean when she says irregular channels of people involved? And you're talking about policy making. Now, I've made the same point. I've made exactly the same point as a general observation about the Trump administration. They have observed and they continue not to observe established order in the way they do business and the way they function. And there's nothing more sinister for the administration than to do what Condoleezza Rice says, operating through irregular channels. That has a lot of weight. That's the way diplomats talk. But everybody understands what she's saying. And it's a very serious indictment. She's leveling a charge, although it doesn't sound like it. She has made it known in this statement, as a former Secretary of State, she is no fly-by-night kind of person here. She has authority with which to speak. And she is remarking about the irregular channels that people in her world, people charged with carrying out, executing U.S. foreign policy, you know who they are. Starting with Donald Trump and all the minions that he orders around to do whatever it is he wants done, despite the fact that there are established ways of operating. And when you choose to go through irregular channels, you are consciously violating not only the sense and the history of how business is done in the world of diplomacy, but you also potentially are committing crimes. And she's saying this on the eve of open door testimony that the nation would get to see. Very subtle. Very subtle. The way she basically attacks Trump and his administration. And as I said, this is no fly-by-night person. This is a very, very credentialed woman, highly respected all over the world, whatever people want to think. This is the fact. And therefore, she has authority to make a judgment call with regard to the Trump administration's handling of the Ukrainian matter. These are very stinging words. And I wonder whether people would, especially in the world, I don't know that they could possibly miss it or misinterpret what she's saying. But this is like sinking an axe handle in the middle of Trump's head. Very serious indictment of his entire administration. Powerful indictment. When you say irregular channels, that takes in Rudolph Giuliani, it takes in Trump's son-in-law, it takes in Trump's son, the oldest one who thinks he is president of the United States as well, and he's dragging in his fiancée to be the stand-in for him when he's not available to excoriate whoever it is he wants to excoriate. But this is how differently people behave in this world of diplomacy. What she just said there, and it doesn't sound particularly dangerous, it doesn't sound particularly alarming what she's saying, but in the world of diplomacy, this is like a bomb. She has just issued an indictment of Trump and his administration with regard to diplomacy. She has just saddled the Trump administration with making serious errors that could, you know, with further investigation, yield basic charges. Who exactly, and I've asked the same question. This administration is whoever wants to do it. I mean, you have Jared Kushner, who has zero experience, actually in charge of organizing peace in the Middle East. How did he get that job? How did he get that responsibility? He has no clue what he's doing. And the person who told him to go do that himself has no clue what he's doing. This is how insane this administration has been since it's been installed in office. So I was pleasantly surprised, because in this world of diplomacy, people are loath to say things negative or critical of another administration. But she didn't hold back. She didn't hold back. And she basically said, look into this. This is not normal. It may not even be legal. But from my experience as a seasoned diplomat, as a credentialed person, this is deeply troubling. Those two words, deeply troubling. And to say that in the context of the times that we're in, where we have articles of impeachment being considered against the president, precisely because of the way he has operated his administration, cutting corners left, right, and center, running a secretive operation that resembles more of a gangster organization than a legitimate governmental enterprise. I have renewed respect for Condoleezza Rice. Well, I wanted to touch on some other things, but I'll leave that for the second half of the program. It is important to, before we go to a break, Trump has suffered yet another loss, He loses the right to block access to his tax records, and that's his latest misfortune, which is well deserved, by the way. He really believes he is way above the law, and all of his children believe that as well. His close associates believe that he has infected every aspect of the government with that philosophy and mentality. We do what we want. Until somebody forces us makes us, compels us to obey the law. But until then, hey, we do what we want. All right, so that sets us up for the second half. Why don't we take this break and come back and get on with part two right after this? Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. So far, this is the question I'm asking you directly. So far, what would you say is the most significant thing that has happened in the Trump impeachment inquiry? Let me repeat it. So far, what would you say is the most significant thing that has happened in the Trump impeachment inquiry? Is it likely to affect the eventual outcome in your view? If so, in what way? If not, why not? Oh yes, a tall order today. But this is why we have to do thinking. And that's the point here, that you're not just a target for other people to unload, television stations and news analysts to offload their opinion and make it yours. No, you do your own thinking. You exercise your own intellectual power. Your power of observation, your power of understanding, the sense that you make of things that are important in your world. So here's the question again. What would you say is the most significant thing so far that has happened in the Trump impeachment inquiry? Is it likely to affect eventual outcome? If so, in what way do you think? If not, why not, do you think? All right, it's a heavy burden, but you could lift it. I am confident of it. 888-874-4888 is the number to call, and let's get ready to rumble. Tony from Orlando, you're on the air.
Hi, Eutrice. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
From seeing what I've been seeing on the news and all this stuff about all this impeachment, I think the most significant thing that I'm looking at, being that next year is a big election year, I think that this whole impeachment process has completely drowned out all of the candidates running for president next year. It's just completely taking all the air, all the oxygen out of the room, and everything they're running on is basically no one cares.
Okay, is that a good thing or a bad thing from your perspective?
I think it's a bad thing if your goal is to take out Trump. I think this impeachment process might have been good 2 years ago, or maybe in the next, in the second term or something like that. But I think it's been the timing of this impeachment process is really, really getting it's like the elephant in the room. It's like it's getting in the way of the candidates. And that's why you don't hear them talking about impeachment. They're trying their best to talk about health care and other issues, but it seems like none of their issues is gathering steam. That's why you're seeing people like the Bloombergs, and I think now I'm even hearing Hillary Clinton is going to get into this thing. It's crazy. But they're getting nervous. The DNC is getting very nervous. And that's what I think is the biggest thing about this whole impeachment.
But what therefore are you seeing unfold before your eyes? You're on the right track.
We're living in very, very divided times. The House, the Congress is divided. The Senate, Donald Trump is going to be impeached, but then he's going to be, acquitted in the Senate. That's basically what's going to happen. That's why they're trying to push this through really fast. They're trying to push it as fast as they can so that they can get about the business of getting back to the candidates running against Trump. But I think that, again, this is just making things more divided than what they are. I mean, the whole process of this whole inquiry process has been partisan. It hasn't been bipartisan. The vote was a very partisan vote to proceed with the inquiry. So it's a very partisan thing that we're seeing. It is very divided, and I think both camps are just getting it just more divided. It's not uniting the country. That's why you're seeing people like Bloomberg trying to get into the race, because he is viewed as like somewhat of a moderate, independent type of candidate. That's what I see. He's trying to target like the. There's a lot of people like me that are sick of all this garbage, really. I'm really, really sick of everything. It's just horrible. It's a constant headache. We wake up every day. It's Trump, 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 Trump. I'm tired of hearing about Trump. You know what I mean? I want to hear about the cat that got saved out of the tree once in a while. You know what I mean? I'm tired of hearing about Trump.
You just want an end to the discussion of Trump already and move on. But in the meantime, there's some real things, real issues to address here. And you hinted at it, and that is the disarray or the seeming disarray of both parties, actually. There's no cohesion, except that one party has the mandate, they think, to move against Trump. The other party has a mandate to defend Trump. But we are not getting at the issue, at the issues involved. But we're seeing how scattered both parties are.
Yes.
We're seeing how scattered the both parties are.
They're both scattering to their respective corners. Like you see the Democrats scattering into their little corner, and then you see the Republicans trying to scatter into their little corner. And that's why there's like a space for people like a Mike Bloomberg to come in and try to run. But I think he's more of a Northeasterner guy. I'm not sure if he's very well known throughout the country. I like Mike Bloomberg, to be honest, in my personal opinion. I know he's a billionaire, and there's this thing about, beating down on billionaires, and billionaires are evil and all that stuff. But he pushes a lot of good policies, like as far as gun control and things like that, and the environment and stuff like that. But I don't think a lot of people know about him too much. But that's why there's a space for somebody like him to jump in the race, because he's more of like an independent kind of, like in the middle kind of ground kind of guy.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm seeing.
Well,
you
gave it a good shot. Thanks so much for starting us off today. Thanks a lot, Tony, for calling in. David from Brooklyn.
Yes,
good to hear from you.
Afternoon, Eutrice.
Hello.
I have a little time today, and I'm so glad to be here again on the program. I have a little different perspective. First of all, if you impeach Trump, that's a lot of energy to give attention to that and get the people all looking at this impeachment process. And in spite of the fact that you impeach Trump, you haven't stopped imperialism of the United States. You haven't stopped the empire. You haven't stopped the endless wars started by the United States in various places. You haven't stopped the situation with the people here who are suffering because of economic difficulty and all the other things that are affecting the people in a negative way. So, you know, that's interesting, but I'm not going to give all my attention to the impeachment of Trump. Now, starting, I think you mentioned something about Mr. Bloomberg, and, you know, I have a different perspective. I think the Democratic part of the Uniparty has decided that Mr. Vice President, you know, Mr. Vice President Biden, is weak in some ways. In other words, you know, if you had a boxing match and you have a super heavyweight like Mr. Trump, and you have a bantamweight Mr. Biden, you know.
You're calling the man bantamweight.
What would happen with a debate between the two of them? You know, I don't think that Mr. Biden would come out very well trying to duel, cross swords with Mr. Trump. So open the door, and you have Mr. Bloomberg standing in the wings. He says, oh, wow, this is opportunity. So, and also the ruling class, the oligarchs that really run the country, the people don't run it. They say, oh, boy, maybe we need to put in a sub. So up jumps Mr. Bloomberg. And, you know, that's why he shows up. That's the way I look at that. So as a replacement for Mr. Biden. Now, the other two front runners up in the, the second and third places, Mr. Sanders and Ms. Warren, the ruling class certainly doesn't want them with any kind of progressive programs that they are coming up with and attracting the people with this and that and the other, all of them progressive about health care and various other things. And, you know, the ruling class wants business as usual. They want the status quo. So, as it stands now, I don't think the Sanders and Warren represent the status quo. At least they're giving that the talk to the people, even though they might realize that even if they got in there, it could be a hard road to go on to accomplish these things. But they're saying the right things. So that's the situation we have now with the situation with the election. So I feel that all these things are interesting, but they don't change anything.
Okay. So what do you find significant? Just the same. The most significant thing that has emerged so far about the contest.
Well, the most significant thing is that things are staying the same. In other words, the Uniparty sees the possibility of the Democratic division getting in, so it wants to protect that possibility with putting in someone that could go up in the ring against Mr. Trump. And that's the thing. All these other things, like Condoleezza Rice, you're talking about her today, but the point is about talking about that's not the normal procedure and so forth for diplomacy. And here we have the CIA and FBI and all the secret police organizations that the government has that's doing underhanded things 24 hours a day all over the world. And she's talking this stuff about, you know, Trump is doing things that are wrong and diplomacy and so forth. So, you know, I don't give that much weight. That's the way I feel.
Okay. Well, thank you and good to hear from you.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Lincoln from Mount Vernon, you're on the air. Are you there? Okay, he's not there. Maat, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Oh, this is Lincoln.
Yes. First of all, I would like, can I respond to the Condoleezza comment you made?
Sure.
Okay, could the irregularity she's talking about is Biden, Rick flying with his son on Air Force Two, and 10 days after going to China, China gives Biden's son a check for $1.5 billion? And what could he have been doing for China that China would pay him $1.5 billion? Could she also be talking about the irregularities of the time that is now exposed that when Biden was vice president, he actually put a squeeze on Ukraine? And then after asking all those things, if those could be the irregularities she's talking about, I find it very troubling that Condoleezza Rice, who was a part of a big lie which caused the death of over 100,000 people, have the nerve to be talking about such irregularities. She should be in prison for the wickedness that she, Cheney, and Bush perpetrated on Iraq. Imagine, Fallujah was flattened. So I think that it goes to show how ignorant we the people are, that we could allow this woman, who should be in prison for that wicked crime, she along with her cohorts, and yet we're going to sit back and listen to her make such criticism. That shows you how much they think we are stupid, that we would find that interesting that she would be making such observations and such comments. She should be hiding someplace. So I find that troubling, that we should overlook her making such comments in the face that she is partly responsible for such a dastardly crime against Iraq.
Okay.
In reference to
but I pointed it out because it was an interesting comment that she made, and I was not linking her past, as it were, with the comment that she made. The comment that she made on its own has its own legitimacy, coming from somebody from that world. I'm not passing judgment on, because nobody could pass judgment. Nobody would succeed or be able to survive judgment on anything they do in the world of diplomacy. I thought it was interesting from the point of view that this is her world, and it is not normally the case that people from that world would openly castigate others from that world. They all do wrong things. They all are responsible for all kinds of things. But that was not the point of my observation. My observation did not have anything to do with her past. And there's no need, there's no obligation to point out her past. That's the point I'm making, is this is what she said. And there's legitimacy to what she said as a person in coming from the world of diplomacy. And what she said was quite serious.
How could we listen to someone making such a statement with such a wicked past? We have to
point out her past. First of all, calm down.
I was just trying to make that point. You could ask
a question without going off. You could ask a question. It's a legitimate question. But
I'm not hard of hearing. But I am calm. I'm not, I'm not ruffled. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening.
Yeah, I'm saying, I know I sometimes tend to get passionate, and it can be misleading, think I'm, all irate, but I'm not irate, But I think if we would be doing an injustice if we did not pay attention to that vicious past.
I heard that, and I recognize it, and I am okay with your observation.
Then in reference now to the Trump situation and the impeachment.
But let me just say this. We can't always operate from the perspective that we have a duty to correct the record every time we speak. I was specifically referring to her comments as a former diplomat herself, Secretary of State. She's the highest diplomatic position. And what you have to say.
I accept that, but this is not an attack on you, I'm just.
It's an attack, period. My point is, it's an attack. And what we need is an analysis. So when you offer an analysis, I listen. I'm grown up. I could handle an attack.
I wanted us to be level-headed when we dissect these things. Another thing, in reference to the impeachment, I think we're doing a complete disservice in the sense that none of us is acknowledging that a lot of this so-called impeachment is really born out of disgruntlement. It is not born out of facts. It is not born out of actually looking at the truth. I mean, for example, why are we ignoring the $1.5 billion that Biden got paid? Isn't that similar to like when the Clinton email occurred and we were all busy about who exposed the email rather than what was the content of the Clinton email, which was very damning? And so they kept us distracted.
You run into this all the time. When you're dealing with a subject, of course, we should expect that everything has a genesis. Everything has a starting point. But sometimes you have to go to the issue at hand. You can't always delve into the history of things in order to make a point about what is current. You can sensibly discuss a subject without having to start from the Pleistocene era.
I think you're being selective then, because I remember when we were talking about that topic on white supremacy, and I myself gave an answer, which I thought that fellow, what's his name, who did all that research, did. He said all what he said historically to say the same thing that he had said. So we have to keep things in context. And if we speak out of context...
This is what you should really appreciate. You don't have to do it. There are ways you can't... It is very possible to have a satisfactory discussion without having to undertake a historical task. You don't have to do it in every instance at all. You can have a perfectly sufficient discussion. And if you want to have a discussion about the genesis of things, here's the thing that I would point back at you. Part of that responsibility is yours. You have to go. That's what I keep saying all the time on this program. Don't wait for me to be the substitute historian for you. If there's something that is being discussed that you think should be amplified or you don't know much about or you wish you knew more, it's up to you to get off your rusty dusty and go to the library and read. It is an expectation, and I used to encounter this a lot when I edited a newspaper. The idea is that people would just sit and wait to have you educate them. No, that does not work. That's not my formula at all. If there's something that is particularly interesting to you, I brought you, for example, the work of Theodore Allen and more than how many pages? I'm expecting that if it is something that is interesting to you, you will begin your project right away. The same way as any other historian, whether it's John Henry Clark or Amos Wilson or Ivan Van Sertima, don't wait for me to bring it to you. That's not my job. My job is to engage in conversation, and with that is the assumption that you're doing your share of the work. And then, on top of that, to indict me because I didn't do a good job of giving you what you want. No. That and a token gets you on the bus. You have a responsibility to yourself. If you hear a subject that you have questions about, go look it up. That's what I do. Go and look it up. I'm not here to be the font of all information. No, I'm here to encourage you to take an interest in certain things so that you can be prepared, as you are now, to engage in conversation. Not to look at me as the person whose job it is to go prepare knowledge for you. This is your job. This is all our jobs.
That of that is to say to you, the same way it was appropriate for us to know that history, I'm saying it's also appropriate for me to bring up the past of Condoleezza. That's the point I'm making. I'm not saying that it wasn't appropriate for you to have brought that fellow on. But I'm saying
I'm saying that it isn't in terms of conversation that we're having and considering the time that is allotted for us to have meaningful exchange of information, we just can't cover everything. So if you have a special reservoir of information about Condoleezza Rice. That, I think, is an excellent thing. And it should be encouraged in everybody who wants to know some more about Condoleezza Rice. Go and research and add it to your information base. But my job, or the job of a conversation that we're having, is not that we should enlighten people and do their work. What I consider to be their work, we're talking about Condoleezza Rice specifically in the context of a statement she made, not of the past and what she's culpable for, what she is to be blamed for. That is not part of my conversation. It was not part of my focus. I focused specifically on something she said yesterday, and that pertained to the current dilemma of how people in the Trump administration, who call themselves diplomats, are operating. She says that is irregular, what they're doing. I cannot now take on the task in the, I'm discussing what she said, specifically what she said yesterday. And that's enough for a conversation. I don't have to go through chapter and verse about who she is, what she did, whether she was right, whether she was wrong, what she's responsible for. That is not part of my focus. You understand? I can't be held responsible for accounting for Condoleezza Rice's foibles or mistakes or whatever. That's not part of the conversation. This is a thing that we have to develop. The ability, first of all, we should have, we should not have expectations that we should tell everybody what everything that is, needs to be known right then and there. No, you want to know, go look it up. Go do some more research. The next time we talk about Condoleezza Rice, you're right in. I was speaking about a statement, a specific statement she made, and what was significant about the statement is that she was speaking as a former Secretary of State and as a person seasoned in the discipline of diplomacy. That's it. I didn't see that I needed to tell people everything about Condoleezza Rice since she was born. That was not pertinent to the discussion. You got to learn how to separate these things sometimes. Thank you, Lincoln, for calling in. And that brings us to the end of our program today. We'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks so much for contributing. And it's always a pleasure to be in your company. Bye-bye.